about the Cosmic Festival Multiverse Theories.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to Justin and Laura and Brian. This has been a very good, very stimulating, very intense conference, and thank you very much for it. The burden of the last talk is weighty, especially after so many things have been talked about, especially given the character of the subject, which lurches unexpectedly between real science and empirical issues, and as we've seen, genuine philosophical issues of the kind that the philosophers are much better at thinking about than physicists. And my talk will be some of both, but will be primarily physics. I hope to address the talk is very straightforward. The aim is to address the title and give an answer to the question and give a existence proof that there are testable multiverse theories by showing one and discussing it in some detail. I should say that this is a concern, this has been a concern of mine since the late 1980s for reasons that we'll come to in the talk. And I think it has been, I started with a paper on what's now called the cosmological natural selection model. And that was so puzzling that after several other papers, I ended up writing a book to really flesh out for myself and explore the implications of that idea, whether true or not true. And it's been very interesting and very gratifying that in the last several years, there's been much more interest in these issues and these concerns. But I also have to say it's been somewhat daunting for reasons that will become clear, because there's been so much more talk and interest in multiverse theories. But for reasons that I'll explain, in my view, most of them fail to address this key issue, and indeed fail to address really the reasons why we're driven to them. And I want to say right off that I really, really, really hope there's not a multiverse. I'm not somebody who has a romantic attachment to the idea, quite the opposite, the idea of Paul's life. But nonetheless, we seem driven not to believe in it, because we're very far from believing it, but we are driven to contemplate it. And I think we should start by reminding ourselves and thinking about why we are driven to this, what I think is properly considered a desperate measure. One broad way to put it, which is sort of romantic, which is the bright side, which I'll start with, was about to be contrasted with the dark side, is that we've been enormously successful at learning what the laws of nature are. And certainly, we don't understand quantum gravity. That is, we have lots of good work and good ideas on different approaches to quantum gravity, but we don't have the quantum theory of gravity. We don't have a theory of unification past the standard model. And indeed, we don't have a single compelling scenario for post-standard model physics. We have many versions of post-standard model physics with their aficionados and professionals working on them. Which is why it's so important that the LHC is being turned on next week. In any case, we know a lot about the laws of nature at some effective level of description. And as some philosophers anticipated, for example, Peirce, more than 100 years ago, as a result of being at this point, we have a new question, which is why these laws and not other laws? And that's the positive side. We have a new question, and And as I said, there were people wondering about that more than 100 years ago, when they had a quite different set of laws in the 1880s and 1890s. But I think we have some justification for asking the question because we have such a highly successful set of laws in the standard model in quantum mechanics and general relativity. Nonetheless, so that's the positive side. And it is very interesting to trace, and I'll be doing some of it, how it is that that shift of questions from what are the laws to why these laws pushes us to contemplate multiverses of the universes. And if I haven't really done the killer thing in it by the end, please remind me, and I'll make that really the closing theme. The dark side is that even though we know a lot about the laws, there's a lot that we don't know. And these have been questions on the table for quite some time. I first heard about them in a talk I heard when I was an undergraduate by Tom Heiss, who said these are the questions which have been on the table for as long as he has been in physics, it is since the 1940s. And in spite of all the progress we've made leading up to including the standard model and so forth, we have a theory, as everybody knows, so I won't dwell on this, with a large set of parameters, and we don't have any idea of why they have the values they do, nor do we have any idea what the gauge groups, why the gauge groups of the standard model are what they are, or what chooses the fermion representations, except one condition on anomaly cancellation. And so these questions are the dark side of why these laws, and as I'll narrate, the attempts to answer them have driven us over the edge of doing science in models which have one universe into contemplating multiverses. And that's either a really good thing or a really bad thing. And the theme of this talk is I'm not going to make an argument whether it's a good thing or whether it's a bad thing, but if we go that way, we had better be careful of ensuring that our theories still have good old-fashioned empirical content and are confirmable or disconfirmable, as the philosophers want us to say. Okay, not only that, there are two distinct aspects of the problem of the parameters which are very puzzling. And it's also very puzzling that there are two puzzles. One is the hierarchy problem. Why is it that so many of the dimensionless ratios between scales, mass scales, and length scales in nature are very large or very small numbers? We have no idea, but it is an observation that there are many large ratios, such as between the proton mass and the Planck mass, the top quark to the electron mass, the value of the cosmological constant, etc. A different problem is what we can call the special tuning problem, and it is the observation that the observed parameters allow the existence of complex and stable structures in the universe over a wide range of scales. With the present values of the parameters, there are on the order of 100 different stable nuclei, these bound states of nuclei. There are many bound states of, there are then atoms, there are many bound states of the atoms, the molecules. And there are big, huge stars which are stable. There are galaxies which are approximately stable over long periods of time. And this did not have to be. And even assuming the hierarchy was explained, this would not be explained. And the realization that in the space of parameters, there is, well, the realization of many people's work, starting from the 1960s, is that there is a small window in the space of the standard model parameters where these situations obtain, where many nuclei are stable, where molecules are stable, where there are long-lived stars which are stable, and so forth. And so the literature about this, for example, work by Martin Rees and collaborators, Paul has been involved in this, and many other people, is often connected with discussions of the anthropic principle, but it's a scientific observation. It has nothing to do with the anthropic principle. So it goes by a name, let's call it the special tuning problem. It has nothing to do with the existence of human beings or observers or anthros or anything. It happens that we live in a world where there are long-lived stars and carbon chemistry and lots of stable nuclear bound states. Okay. Why? Okay. Now, the next few slides I'm going to skip, but if somebody raises questions that force me to go back to the details, I just have some slides of the whole variety of these special tunings and that these people discovered. And some of them are quite surprising. For example, that there are convective stars turns out to involve a relationship between the proton mass, the Newton's constant, the electron mass, and the fine structure constant. And that there are supernova constraints, the weak interactions, the Fermi constant. And those are quite surprising, but there's good arguments for them, which I'm not going to repeat. Okay. Yes.
So this is just a question about the special tuning problem. So I've always wondered, in the context of these arguments, is there any reason? Okay, now let me start again. So we're familiar with particular types of complexity, long-lived stars, carbon chemistry, and so forth, and we can reassure ourselves that in order to get complexity of that particular kind, the parameters have to be in these particular small windows. But in order for me to get puzzled about the special tuning problem, I need a stronger claim to be being made, namely, in order to get complexity of any kind at all, so in order for the evolution of life in any sense, there would have to be similar fine-tuning going on. Can that stronger claim be made also?
Let me distinguish two kinds of stronger claims. Okay. One, looking in the neighborhood of the position of the point in parameter space where we are, okay, and asking as we go away from that neighborhood in many different directions, after all, we have just from the standard model of 29-dimensional parameter space, do structures fall apart and no new structures appear as we explore small changes? Because that's something that we reliably can do. And a lot of the discussion devoted to the evidence that what is taken as, I think, fallaciously as evidence for the anthropic principle consists of good scientists working through details of those things. You know, what if the proton-neutron mass difference were raised 10%? What if it were raised 50%? And there, I think, one can defend the claim that the major structures in nature fall apart in different directions, in many different directions going outside this window. Going far away in parameter space, look, this is science. And, there are claims in the literature. I think it's very dubious that one can make firm claims far away from where we are in the parameter space. If we were just given the standard model, would we predict the existence of carbon chemistry? So I think that there's a good caution there, and you're raising it. But I think that there's no particular reason to believe that structure somehow is generic in the space. So sometimes people have said, well, maybe just different structures form.
Right.
Okay. So I have never seen a positive argument to that.
Okay, but also none against it either.
Yes, but when you examine what's, but let me, when you examine, let me leave it there. If you need more to convince you to take an interest in this, that's all I can say. Okay. Now, yes.
Why do you say that's nothing to do with anthropic? I mean, life's existence depends
for the very important reason, and this will be crucial for my talk, that the fact that carbon is the most abundant metal in the parlance of astronomers, in the universe, has nothing to do with the fact that we are made of carbon. It is an astronomical observation that carbon is the most abundant element of those produced in stellar and nuclear synthesis.
Well, what about the most, more general argument that life as we know it depends on the existence of lots of these stable structures and so on?
And I'll come to it if you, by the way, I have a lot to say, so I'm going to try to not be completely swayed by discussion. There is a precise sense in which it's, in many contexts, there are arguments made which are fallacious, because a good scientific argument is made, and an unnecessary reference to the fact that living things are made out of carbon is added, which has no logical force in the argument. And so in that technical sense, or strict logical sense, yes, it may, you know, we are made of carbon, we are observers, etc., but there are facts which are confirmable, like the existence of carbon, the existence of bound states, you know, of dark matter and baryons, which are galaxies, which we can confirm having nothing to do with what living things exist or are made of. Okay. Let me go ahead. So, Tom, I just introduced the fine-tuning problem and the problem of why the parameters are finely tuned for structure and the hierarchy problem. Okay. So, roughly speaking, four kinds of explanations have been proposed, okay? And let's look at them. The first one is the one that, you know, I went into physics to contribute to, that I would still like to believe if it were possible, which is that there would be a unique unification of all forces, and this would have a unique ground state which would explain the standard model, explain all the choices made in the construction of the standard model, and explain the parameters. And I don't have to, as the last talk, spend a lot of time on the observation that this isn't playing out at the present time, although something always could change. I think it's important to emphasize that I'm convinced by the evidence for the semi-classical stream vacua, but there are skeptics, there are experts who are who are skeptical for reasons we could mention in the discussion. But at the present time, neither in string theory nor in any of the other approaches to unification of quantum gravity is there anything that addresses in a hopeful way that hope. And I want to something I want to emphasize, because the younger people may not know it, is that this worry has been in the literature about string theory since 1986. There were a couple of papers, one of them, which certainly is the paper that got me started worrying about this problem, was a paper on torsion in string theory by Andy Strominger, and he found a very vast class of compactifications with torsion extending across the out compactifications. And he worried in 1986 that, you can read it on your own, I hate when somebody reads the transparency in me, but let me emphasize, Andy worried that all predictive power seems to have been lost, and this points to the overwhelming need to find a dynamical principle for determining the vacuum. So the issue has been on the table, and there were a couple of people in Europe who wrote papers emphasizing the same issue. So the issue has been on the table since then. It took some years, which is just some, the travails of research. It took some years for a lot of people to start to worry about it, but the issue has been there for some time. What about alternatives to string theory? There are some interesting ideas about matter, but there's nothing that is worth raising in this regard. Okay. I still would love to live in one universe that was described by one theory that explained everything that was measured. Okay. But that is the situation as it stands with the first approach. The second approach, doesn't appeal to me, but I think is intellectually respectable in the sense that there are smart people, some of them are scientists, who are writing careful stuff about it, is the explicit, shameless, theological anthropic principle, sometimes called the strong anthropic principle, that there is a God who made the universe and made the universe in such a way, not only that there would be intelligent creatures who would come to exist and have the possibility of knowing about God and loving him, but that God set it up with a trick so that when we would understand the science well enough, we would realize that our existence was very improbable, and therefore we would rationally come to the view that we should believe in God. And there are, you know, good people like George Ellis, who I think is a very good scientist, promoting this. And I don't think it's science, but I think it's, we should be mindful of it because it's a fallback position for a lot of people. And if we don't do better, a lot of people are going to go there. And I'm not talking about crazy creationists. I mean, these are, you know, fellow scientists who are mild forms of, you know, Quakers or Anglicans or something like that.
Lee, who is the quotation from? Is
I that's my paraphrase of George Ellis, his book. George Ellis has a book, which argues this.
But the strong anthropic principle is not about God only. It could be cosmic engineers or some abstract theological force or something.
Sure.
So it's not a subscription to...
Sure. Okay. Anyway, I bring it up because we had better, if I believe in science, and we had better do better than this. Okay, now, given that the first one is not working out for us, and the second one is not science, the other approaches to these problems are multiverse scenarios. And I think that that is striking. I think it's something that philosophers and maybe historians of science could reflect on. I mean, I don't know if this is worth historians' attention yet, but if the discussions continue. I think it is the case that it is really being caught between the failure of the first option, at least presently, and the danger of the second option, we have been driven to contemplate multiverse scenarios. And so let's talk about them. There are several different ones. There have been a number of classifications in this conference of multiverse scenarios. I'm only interested in one distinction, which I'll call static and dynamic, and I'll be defining them more carefully. Roughly speaking, what that means is the ensemble on the space of parameters on the space of multiverses, is this something that has no time evolution and is therefore static, or is it something which intrinsically evolves in time? And you'll see as I go on my reasons for making that distinction. There are, and roughly speaking, the two representatives of them are eternal inflation, which is certainly the most studied version of a multiverse theory, and cosmological natural selection, which is much less studied, but is an example of what I'll be calling a dynamic one. Yeah.
I'm a little puzzled by your calling eternal inflation static. Everybody I know who talks about it is always talking about how we tunneled from this vacuum to that vacuum, and there was the one just before us, and the one that we would eventually tunnel into, which is.
You'll see how I use the issue. Okay. I'm not saying there's not dynamics. Oh, don't misunderstand. I'm not saying there's not dynamics which explains the ensemble. I'm saying there is a belief that the ensemble comes to a kind of equilibrium or time independence as a result of that dynamic.
It's the synthesis, right?
Well, okay. No.
Well, it's not the synthesis.
It's not the synthesis. It always decays long before the synthesis.
Patches,
And these are broad. I'd be very happy if there was more talk of time dependence and eternal inflation. This is not a talk against eternal inflation. that talk about how what's required for everybody to do well with whatever assumptions they have. Okay, so let me now talk about the weak anthropic principle, which I'll try to define carefully. And again, the weak anthropic principle doesn't coincide with eternal inflation. It is often talked about at the same time, but they're independent ideas. And I'm here critiquing, I'm not critiquing eternal inflation, I'm critiquing the weak anthropic principle. And I want to discuss the setup a little bit carefully, and then criticize it. There we deal, if we think what we're doing, about what we're doing carefully, with two spaces of parameters. There's some fundamental theory, which has some fundamental space of parameters. And there's an analogy to biology, which sticks out, so I just use it to orient us. So this is what the biologists call the genotype. And then there's a space of the low energy parameters that we measure. In the case of particle physics, the standard parameter space of the standard model. In biology, the phenotype. Okay, so L and P, just to give them names. And there's a map between them, which it is the job of theoretical physicists and phenomenologists to work out in detail. And there's no claim that it's a simple map. Certainly, for example, biology, it's very far from a simple map. And there's a probability distribution here, which the fundamental theory produces. And then that's mapped to a probability distribution there. Okay. And what I mean by static is simply that there isn't a function, an important function of time in this probability distribution. The reasoning that's done doesn't require that there be time dependence here. Okay. Then the observation is made that life doesn't exist in most of the parameter space. So there's a small region of parameter space, which we can call F for fine. And now, I'm simplifying, even though I'm trying to be careful, I'm simplifying some arguments that a lot can be said about. If the probability distribution here is random or equilibrium, then it doesn't know about fine details of structure that forms in small regions of the parameter space here. If the probability distribution here is generated by processes in inflation, which are going on at a scale of 10 to the 15 GeV. So here I am making an example of eternal inflation. The probability distribution here, then mapped over here, is unlikely to know about why this region of this parameter space is any different from any other region, because there's an enormous mismatch of scales from here to here. Therefore, unless we have a particular example where somebody does something that comes out otherwise, we can assume that the probability distribution restricted to the part of the parameter space with his life is constant. Okay. And that's what's mostly assumed, and that's why it's mostly assumed, because when we need something very special happening to get otherwise. Okay. Now, therefore, if the probability distribution is constant on the small region of the standard model parameter space where we can live, then there are some consequences which are consequences of being in that region. But if you ask about consequences for parameters that don't affect the possibility of life, such as the top quark mass within wide ranges, not infinite ranges, but wide ranges, or even strange quark mass within wide ranges, one is not going to get any predictions because the probability of life existing is not going to depend on those parameters. Okay. So therefore, there are two kinds of parameters. There are parameters on which the existence of life depends, in which case one argues that one is somewhere in that region, and one gets that back, or there are parameters on which the existence of life does not depend, in which case one gets no predictions from this kind of scenario.
I'm completely puzzled by what you're saying now, because if you say that indeed a prediction is that except for those parameters that are necessary for life, we should get a flat distribution on all the other parameters, then we already have experimental evidence that this kind of idea is wrong, right? Because there are many parameters of the standard model which are tuned much more than they would have to be for life.
That's a very important observation. Can we come back to that at some point?
Okay, but so that means it is falsifiable. It's all maybe already false.
Yes, good. So let's come back to that. Good, thank you. Okay. So that's the conclusion. Okay. Now, to avoid this, what we would like, and to be able to capture some of the examples that Tom is referring to that we can discuss later, what one would like is a probability distribution here that was not flat on the parameters that have no influence of life, or in the regions they have no influence of the existence of life. And to get that, we need to start from something here which is structured, and therefore, presumably, if these things have meaning in the theory, non-random, out of equilibrium, we need, in other words, if we start there, we need a lot of structure there to get structure remaining in the little region F. So that's the conclusion I draw from this.
To sort of quantify the tininess of that, you tweak the standard model parameters up to a certain number of percent, and that still allows you to remain within the realm of stable structure. So what, roughly what percent do you have in that dimensional space?
Various people have made that estimate. It, you know, I don't remember one part in 10 to 270. I don't remember, but it's in many of the books on the subject, including the one I wrote.
Well, for a typical parameter, what percentage? Something like 1% dimension, proton mass versus the neutron mass.
Well, so we can talk about all this. So if the proton neutron mass difference is increased, I don't remember what the numbers are, but more than something like 30%. Then most bound states fall apart. Most nuclear bound states fall apart.
The sensitive one is if you reverse the mass ratio between neutron and proton, it's 0.01% in favor of the neutron. If it were around the other way, the protons would decay, and that would be disastrous for life.
Yes.
That's not a fundamental theory. That's a sort of effective theory. You have to get back to QCD.
Right. But I mean, there are many, many things. And they affect the known physics in different ways. But if the electron mass is increased more than a certain amount, again, you don't get bound states. If the fine structure constant is increased, again, I don't remember, 20%, something like that.
Quite a bit, I think, for that one.
Maybe it's 30.
As Brandon Carter told me a long time ago, 1971 to be precise, the reason we call it the fine structure constant is because it affects only the fine structure of atoms and not the gross structure. So it's the sensitivity of chemistry to the fine structure constant is very fine. And then he's followed up by saying, I'm surprised you made such a silly mistake.
Okay. Anyway, there are subtleties that I will come back to that passing over. But nonetheless, at this level, there's an issue. Because in the literature, there are claims that the entropy principle is predictive, and if my argument has any force, these must be fallacious. So let's look at a few of these, and I will be claiming there are two characteristic mistakes of reasoning that a lot of people, I should emphasize, don't make. A lot of people in this field are careful and don't make these mistakes, but they are in the literature, and therefore it's important to be warned about them. Okay, so here's a famous argument of Fred Hoyle from the 1930s, I believe. It goes, carbon is necessary for life to exist. In fact, carbon is abundant in the universe. Using the laws of physics, we can deduce that for carbon to exist, and this is what he did, there must be a residence at a certain energy in the beryllium nuclei. Hence, we predict that that resonance exists. And he told his friends about this, and Willie Fowler and his group did the experiment, and indeed a resonance was found at the appropriate energy. Now, where's the fallacy? I think the fallacy is clear. The first line, and this is what I was referring to, Rob, the first line plays no role in the force of the argument. And how can you be sure? Supposing that the resonance had not been found, he would have checked his calculations. He would not have questioned the existence of life or the necessity of life to have carbon. So that's just a straightforward fallacious argument. What Coyle did was good science, but had nothing to do with life, the anthropic principle observers, or anything like that. Okay. There are multiverse versions of this, which work the same way. We live in a multiverse with random laws distributed over a vast ensemble. Carbon is necessary for life to exist. Hence, we must live in one of those universes that have carbon. The rest of it goes the same. Where's the fallacy? The fallacy is that the only thing that's playing a logical role is the fact that carbon is plentiful in the universe. Okay. And this is just to make a note of caution. Okay. If in the end we're making a prediction about a property of our universe, there are, I will be arguing, cases in which we can deduce from a multiverse theory predictions about our single universe that we can observe, but there's a lot of things that go like this that we should be wary of.
Why does it matter if carbon's abundant? Why can't you just say for carbon to exist, there must be?
Oh, because what Coyle is trying to explain is not that carbon is stable, but that it was made abundantly in stars.
But it's easy to make.
It's easy to make, and it's quite common. Okay. Now, the cosmological constant often comes up, and there's a fallacy about how it comes up, so I want to be clear about this. So the following is a similar argument about the cosmological constant, which is not the famous argument of Weinberg. And let me just point out how it goes. It starts the same way. We live in a multiverse with random laws distributed, etc. Galaxies are necessary for life to exist. Hence, we must live in a universe with galaxies. In fact, galaxies are abundant. Using the laws of physics, we deduce that for galaxies to have formed, the cosmological constant must be less than some value lambda zero. We call it lambda Weinberg. Hence, we predict that the cosmological constant was found 10 years ago, roughly, with a value less than that value. Now, this is an argument which is subject to the same critique. It only actually uses the observed fact that galaxies exist. But this is not the argument that Weinberg made. It's sometimes asserted that it is. It's a fallacious argument, but it's not a fallacy that Weinberg made. Weinberg made a much more interesting argument, okay, which does talk about the multiverse. Okay. So this argument starts the same way. Okay. Then he says, since the probability distribution is random on the subensemble that involves life, i.e. flat, that's the assumption that I made in discussing the general case, okay, then we would expect, since we're a typical member of the ensemble, where life exists and where the cosmological constant has a distribution which is essentially flat, we should expect to see a value of the cosmological constant which is on the order of the limit. And that's a much more interesting argument. And that argument bears some thought, and the question is that really a testable prediction? And here there's a subtlety, which was, there's a lot of literature about this. It depends on the ensemble study. If you now ask, so there is the value lambda zero, which is estimated, and the observed value, and in different models, one makes assumptions about what is the ensemble and what varies in the ensemble. And in the simplest model, in which only the cosmological constant varies in the ensemble, then one can estimate that the probability to see the present value is about 10%. To see a value smaller than or equal to the present value is about 10%. So it's not one, but 10% is not bad. This was considered a success, the argument. On the other hand, supposing one allows in the ensemble two parameters to vary, lambda and delta rho over rho, which is the scale of the fluctuations of the primordial cosmological fluctuations. Okay. Then you have to ask, what's the probability to see the present values of both parameters within the domain allowed by the existence of life? The idea why there's a dependence is that if delta rho, if you increase the cosmological constant, the universe expands too fast and galaxies might not form. But if you increase delta rho over rho, you have more fluctuations, stronger fluctuations at the beginning, and some galaxies can still form. So in that problem, the probability to have lambda in the observed range goes down to a part in 10,000. And it's a less successful argument. And this demonstrates a caution with what's often talked about as the notion of typicality. There's often a move made in such discussions to say, there is a notion of typicality, and then which is defined, and then conclusions are drawn from it. And it is sometimes the case, and this is a case where the success of such an argument is unstable to what the notion of typicality is that one uses. It's successful in one notion of typicality and not so successful in another. Okay, so the conclusion, which I'm about to modify, so don't jump on me, I'm about to tell you about exceptions to it, so this is deliberately a bit too strong, is that this methodology leads to no falsifiable predictions. And I'm about to modify it. Okay, and the argument is as I've given it, because this kind of reasoning produces a distribution which is flat for the parameters that don't affect the existence of life in the ranges they don't on the space F, then it cannot lead to any conclusions about the values of those parameters. And claims to the contrary have trouble or tend to commit two fallacies. One of them is adding the extra unnecessary assumption, and the other is making claims on typicality which are not checkable. Since we don't observe the ensemble of other universes, we're free to invent a lot of things about them, or to study different theories that produce different ones of them. And if the notion of typicality varies, therefore, and if the conclusions depend on the notion of typicality, we can often find that we have a much weaker argument than we thought.
Okay. Lee, can I ask a question and then leave? Because you may answer the question later on, but I have to
go.
You're talking about falsifiability, making predictions, but you can use the weak anthropic argument to explain things, not so much a prediction, but an explanation. And I've never heard anybody deny Dickey's use of this to explain the large number coincidences. So it seems to be a very satisfactory use of anthropic reasoning.
Yes, and I'm not going to discuss that because I agree with you.
Good. At that point, I will say goodbye.
Okay. And I'm going slower than I intended to, but as with everybody else's talk, we'll see what we get. Okay. What I just said is a bit too strong because there are extreme cases. And let me credit these extreme cases. One, supposing it happens that the distribution of some property that life doesn't depend on is not flat, but say every member of the ensemble that your theory produces has a given property, then of course you predict that property. So there are some extreme cases like this, and an example of it, and there are subtleties and arguments here, and I'm only pointing out as an example of a kind of argument, is the claim of Lenny Susskind and collaborators that, and it's right there, that if that there are consequences of a scenario where universes are born from tunneling from neighboring positive cosmological constant vacua, and that includes having negative spatial curvature. So there are some, that's a, I don't know, I think that's a legitimate argument, and you know, it can and has been criticized on technical grounds, but if it stands on technical grounds, it's a claim made by that version of eternal inflation. Okay. Now, there's another case which is possibly like that, and here I'm going to refer to some papers in the literature about the string theory landscape, and I don't know if the assumptions of this argument still hold up. This is an argument suggested in some correspondence with George, by George Ellis, but it's an example. So I don't know if the conclusion of the argument is correct, because I don't know if the assumptions are still correct, but it's a kind of argument of an extreme case. Supposing the ensemble that we're interested in, the ensemble of universes, is a discretely infinite, and all but a finite subset have a given property, P. Then, okay, one generically predicts P, that is almost every probability distribution on that space will predict that you're in the set which is discretely infinite rather than the set which is discretely finite. Okay, and this is the thing that I don't know if it still holds up, but it did hold up. It was a description of some results in the literature of 2 years ago. Consider two ranges of the cosmological constant anthropically allowed. One where the cosmological constant is smaller than the Weinberg limit in positive, and one where it's negative and its absolute value is smaller than a similar bound for negative cosmological constant. Okay? And supposing, and this is the way the literature was a couple of years ago, that there is a large but finite set of vacua in the first ensemble and a discrete infinity of vacua in the second ensemble, then a generic probability distribution that doesn't have a bias towards positive or negative cosmological constants, okay, will predict that a randomly chosen anthropically allowed universe will have negative cosmological constants. So it's an example, and there's the papers that was based on. So so that's an example of a kind of claim that can be made when you have extreme situations. Okay, so the conclusions are the same, except I append that there are extreme situations. Okay, that's the critique of the weak anthropic principle. And now I want to turn to the fourth and less studied option, which is the idea akin to natural selection. And I want to give a careful presentation of it and motivation, and then as much as people want to discuss details of how it's holding up. Okay. And to motivate it, this is a quotation from Charles Sanders Peirce, the great American pragmatist, who anticipated the general idea, and I think anticipated the general idea for an interesting reason, which is worth reflecting on if we're going to take the plunge and reflect on multiverse theories. Okay. And what he says, again, you can read it, but what he says is that the most important question in science is why these laws. He anticipated that science physics would get to the point where we thought we knew what the laws were. Okay? And he says that that can't be the end. That would be to let things stand inexplicable and irrational. That's not justified. We have to account for laws. Laws are precisely the sort of things that have to have explanations. And then he says the only possible way of accounting for the laws of nature is to suppose them results of evolution. And he, by the context, he had natural selection in mind, and he was indeed very influenced by Darwin. So So I find it remarkable that he came to that view. And whether that view is correct or not, I think it's one that should properly be on the table and critiqued and considered. And the rest of the talk is an argument to take it seriously. Now, what does it mean to apply natural selection? Natural selection has been formalized. It's not just about DNA and biological cells. What does one need at a formal level to apply to make an explanation via natural selection? One needs a space of parameters and a bunch of entities that have values of those parameters, such as the genes or the parameters of a fundamental theory in some region of the universe. One needs a mechanism of reproduction. One needs that mechanism for under reproduction for those parameters to change slightly from parent to child. And I'll be precise about what slightly means in a few transparencies. And we need it to be the case that reproductive success depends strongly on the parameters. And if you satisfy those formal conditions, there are mathematical models of population biology that you can apply. And you can reach conclusions. And notice that this fits thematically with the conclusion that I argued for before, that if we're going to explain things like the proton-neutron mass difference or the fine structure constant, or the value of the electron mass, from a multiverse theory, we need some process which generates an ensemble which is not random, which has a lot of structure in it on the fundamental parameter space, so that when we go down to the effective parameter space of the standard model, it can be sensitive to whether or not the proton-neutron mass difference is within some interesting range or not. That's what I just said there in red. Okay. Now, as in biology, and as in the weekend logic principle, there are the same two parameter spaces. The fundamental parameter space and the effective parameter space. And then one runs a standard argument in population biology. Okay. Now, let's just look to fill in the next things we need. We need a method for reproduction of universes, a method for the parameters to change in ways that are small, and we need a strong dependence of reproduction on the parameters. And I should say that I was very perturbed by and provoked by that paper of Andy Strominger and some conversations we had. And the origin of my interest in this is I went looking for this. That is, I raised the question, is there anywhere in science where there is a methodology that allows us to explain fine tunings of parameters on which a lot of the question of whether there's a lot of complexity or not in the system depend, and went to steal methodology from other parts of science where a successful scientific argument had been made to explain a fine tuning which led to much more structure. And having reached this point, I played and some other people have played with a lot of different scenarios. Okay, so this is not, and my view is that the logic of the scenario is interesting and, for the reasons that I'm arguing, worth consideration. Whether the particular realization I'm about to tell you about stands or falls is less interesting, except that if it stands or falls, it stands or falls on empirical grounds, which is the whole point. That is, this is a scenario which makes a few predictions, which are straightforward predictions which can be confirmed or disconfirmed by observation. So after there are a bunch of ideas which didn't work, including some associated with eternal inflation and some associated with doing everything within one universe, and eventually at least one way of doing it appeared. Okay, so the method of reproduction of universes is bounces in black holes. And there is by now a literature about, and we have some experts here, who using methods from different approaches to quantum gravity have studied the elimination of cosmological singularities and also black hole singularities. And there, you know, there is a literature, I would characterize it, I don't know how you would characterize it, I would characterize it, there's a literature where there are models within which there's good evidence that black hole singularities and cosmological singularities bounce. Is that, do you agree?
Yeah, it's the same thing that we had in common for this equilibrium singularity.
Yeah.
We can solve this problem mainly in the case of non-homogeneous space time, but in particular in the homogeneous cases, using the quantum approach and the ideas.
Yeah. So these are models, but this is not yet, you know, loop quantum gravity or string theory or some fully worked through quantum field theory of gravity predicts bounces, but these are models of increasing complexity in which there are always bounces. Okay, so I just propose we take that on board, and we take it on board in the simplest form, which is that each black hole in the universe that is the future region of every apparent horizon of a black hole does not have a singularity, it has a bounce, which gives rise to a new region of space-time.
Lee, would you agree that in order to entertain this hypothesis, you have to reject the notion that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a black hole counts the number of states of the black hole? Of the point?
Yes, and I've written about that. I think there is, we
so
can expect
that.
That's
wrong. You think that the idea that the black hole entropy is the number of states of the black hole is incorrect?
Yes. I think it counts the capacity of the channel of passage of quantum information through the horizon. Okay. As far as now we need a theory with the landscape. This is not special to string theory. And one can think about the string theory landscape. One can think about whatever other theory if one is interested in something else. The only point that I need is that the variation of parameters, when it's projected onto the effective parameter space of the standard model, is small. And again, we'll come to what small means. Okay. And this, there is, I think, no theoretical support for or against. So I'm just going to assume this and go ahead. Now we need the fitness to depend strongly on the parameter space. And from here on, I'm going to work on the standard model effective parameter space, which is just like the biologist working on the space of phenotypes rather than genotypes, which is, after all, what they did when Darwin and Mendel actually worked originally with these kind of ideas. So the definition of fitness as a function of a value, a set of parameters of the standard model, is the average number of black holes created to the future of the bounce for universe with parameter p. And that's not the cumulative number to the far future, that's just the number of immediate bounces. So,
are you suggesting that there's some heredity between these universes, that there's, or
each
universe is really just like a brand new.
No, and it's very important, and I should credit that Johnny Wheeler, you know, if you look in Misnephone and Wheeler, Johnny Wheeler was playing with this scenario in the 1960s and 1970s. He called it reprocessing the universe. Okay, and the only thing that's added here from what he played, and he also had a biological metaphor in mind, and so on, but the only thing that's changed is the requirement that the average variation in the parameter space of the standard model is small. So it's not a reinvention of a random chosen universe each time. So there is heredity, and that's very important. Okay, because you don't climb, basically, this is about, you know, if you think in terms of search algorithm, this is about a mechanism to climb hills. Okay? And to climb hills, you need two things. One of them is you need hills, which I'll just be discussing right now. You need there to be hills to climb. And you need to go in small incremental steps to climb hills, to get to local maximum. And because of the remark I made to Hillary at the very beginning, I'm only interested in local maximum. Let me say that at the beginning. Okay. So it's easy to show that the fitness does depend strongly on the parameters in the standard model. That is that if we change the parameters from the present value in the neighborhood of the present value, which is, as I said before, is the only thing we can really reliably talk about, that the number of black holes produced does change strongly in some directions of the parameter space. So there are some directions where the number of black holes produced is very sensitive to whether you're at the present point in parameter space or you move off of it. And the discussion of the details of the theory, of testing the theory, has to do with going through those cases. So I'll just assert that for now. Okay. What you can conclude from this and standard from these assumptions, these are assumptions and standard methodology from population biology, is that after a sufficient number of steps from a random start, the population evolves to one which is peaked around local extrema of the fitness function. There's definitely no claim here about global extrema. We're only making a claim about local extrema. That implies that almost no changes in the low energy parameters should lead to an increase in the expected number of black holes produced. We should be near a local extrema if we're a typical member of this ensemble. Okay. And notice, very importantly here, there is no anthropic cutting of the ensemble. Okay. Without using the anthropic observation or move or whatever, the method here is to now let the population evolve until it's peaked around local extrema, and then pick a typical member of the ensemble and compare its properties with our observed universe. And the one property that I can claim from the beginning is that our observed universe should have the property that its parameters are near a local extrema, local maxima of the fitness function, which means that most ways of changing the parameters from the present value, small amounts, should either be neutral, does not change the numbers of black holes, or decrease the number of black holes. If there are ways which to change the parameters which strongly increase the number of black holes by changing parameters from the present value, this theory is wrong. So it has empirical content which is much stronger than the previous methodology we discussed, precisely because we pick a typical member of the ensemble. We don't first truncate the ensemble to a very small portion of it, which satisfies the anthropic, which is anthropically satisfying.
Why doesn't increasing delta rho over rho increase the number of black holes?
It depends on the following. Okay. So there are many questions like this that we can now just because. Okay, but let me just address that. In single field inflation, in single field single parameter inflation, then delta rho over rho goes like, I don't remember, I think the square root of the inflaton self coupling. And
in some particular lambda phi postmodern.
And meanwhile, the number of E foldings goes like 1 over, and I have this later, but it goes like 1 over lambda to some power.
This is silly, because there are many models in which those
things
are decoupled from each other.
I agree, and therefore, if there is observational evidence against this simple model of inflation and in favor of another one, this theory is wrong. So, for example, had, if the observation of non-Gaussianities turns out to be real, this theory is in trouble. This is a theory which is very vulnerable to disconfirmation, and here are some ways it is. Okay?
So what you're saying is there are some very special theories of inflation in which the statement that you made about the fitness
has to be
maximized at our values of the parameters happens.
Right. Right. And then one can do a calculation. One doesn't just leave it here. One can do an estimate, which I did in the first paper I wrote about this, to compare the exponential growth here with some estimate of the growth here, and make a prediction for where one should be. Okay.
So you rely on 5 and 4, am I understanding?
I was thinking of the new inflation with the logarithmic, the 5 to the 4th log phi squared potential at the time, but I think it's also true in the lambda 5/4 log.
Because lambda 5/4 is in trouble by now.
I know. That's, from my point of view, my interest, and this is not rhetorical. Okay. I think the methodology here is useful because it produces a theory which is highly vulnerable to disconfirmation. And it may very well be that it's disconfirmed. In which case, and in any case, I think it would be interesting to look for other examples which are similarly vulnerable. And what I want to emphasize is why this is so vulnerable. And it's so vulnerable, one, because it really depends, the fitness function really depends on lower energy fitness parameters, which I'll get to in a minute. And two, because you don't have the freedom of playing with the notion of typicality and truncating the ensemble and so forth. And one has to take the whole, that is, our universe has to be a typical member of the ensemble which is self-produced, not an atypical member in the tail of some distribution. And that makes it much more vulnerable, and I claim that's good. That's the point. Now, let me do a little bit, because it's sort of fun. I had to learn a lot of astrophysics in order to think about this. And let me just give a taste of some of the ways that this is testable. Okay. And what this is just a guide to thinking. What this is a sort of flowchart of how one goes in a galaxy to black holes through various processes. And the important thing is that in a typical disk galaxy, so there are some interesting facts about disk galaxies which all of a sudden become interesting and therefore puzzling. One of them is that in disk galaxies, there are the media of disk galaxies are far from equilibrium, and they are maintained in a far from equilibrium state for time scales long compared to the dynamical time scales in the galaxy by some feedback processes. And those feedback processes have an amazing consequence, which is that star formation decays not over the time scale of the dynamical process or the time scale of the initial formation of the galaxy, but over the cosmological time scale. And this is puzzling. You can ask this problem, you know, why is it that a typical disk galaxy, you know, 10 billion years after it was formed, is still forming stars at roughly the same rate it was forming stars once it settled down to its steady state? And the answer is that there are important feedbacks which govern the interchange of matter and energy between different phases of the interstellar medium. And these govern the rate of formation of massive stars. Another thing which is highly puzzling is that the initial mass function, and I would love to know more about this, but the initial mass function is not an exponential. It's not, the initial mass function is the distribution of masses of stars at the time they're born. It's not dominated by some scale like a solar mass. It's a power law, and that means that quite a few massive stars get made, and that means that quite a few supernovas happen, and that means that quite a few black holes happen. So if one wants to understand how many black holes get produced in the lifetime of a disk galaxy, one has to think about the processes which govern. So we can start, say, from here there are reservoirs of gas and dust. They cool. Some regions cool to a few degrees Kelvin, which are giant molecular clouds. They seem to spontaneously form light stars, but massive stars are formed by other processes which are stimulated by shock waves which come from supernovas, which then form massive stars. So there's a feedback loop right there. And then the supernovas return most of the gas and the dust to the interstellar medium, and the remnants become neutron stars or black holes. And you can ask, what are the critical junctures? You can think like an engineer and ask, what are the critical junctures to run this process so you get as many black holes as possible? And it's a way to teach yourself astrophysics. So one is that you need supernovas to get supernovas, as you need supernovas to get massive stars because they catalyze the collapse of cores of giant molecular clouds. Hence, this offers an explanation for one of the fine tunings which I had on one of the first slides, which is why the Fermi constant is tuned so that there are supernovas. The cooling, you don't get giant molecular clouds unless you have cooling, and the cooling requires refrigerant, that is a mechanism to dissipate heat, and shielding, because massive stars are formed in giant molecular clouds, and if there wasn't shielding, they would just disrupt the cloud, and that would be a negative, a strong negative feedback on massive star formation. And the cooling, it turns out, is primarily in radiation of vibrational modes of carbon monoxide. So the existence of carbon and oxygen is implicated in the question of how many black holes are formed. So again, if this succeeds, I'm not claiming it succeeds, but if this succeeds, it offers a genuine non-anthropic explanation for Hoyle's observation that the parameters are tuned so lots of carbon is made. There's also the dust, which is mostly carbon and ice, which again underlines that. There's an argument about separation of scales. Let me skip that because that's a bit involved. Let me just say that the point is that one needs long-lived stars to get a good separation of scales so that these feedback processes can run efficiently. But that's the weakest and the most technical of these arguments. So there's a possibility of an explanation of things that otherwise are claimed to be accounted for by the anthropic principle, which is what an alternative to the anthropic principle must do, is offer a real explanation, which is non-circular and non-anthropic.
Lee, your fitness function just counts the number of black holes, is that right?
Yes.
It doesn't, a bigger black hole doesn't count for more?
That's a different version of the theory. And you can play with that version of the theory. Mm-hmm. So for example, there's a paper by Mukhanov and collaborators, Prolov, I think, in which they make some models and they conclude that the number of black holes of new universes or bounces formed to replace the singularity of a black hole may go like the power of the mass of the black hole. And one can disconfirm those right away. For example, I think Prolov proposes the fourth power. And that would mean you would want a universe where basically, clouds, the dark matter conspire just to have big galaxy-sized clouds of things just collapse to black holes right away. And so this very much is, you know, one for one and dependent on one for one.
So would we predict that there will be very few galaxy mergers then, which after all take two black holes maybe and make one?
I'm not sure. Ask me. I've thought some about that and I'm confused about that. But in any case, the black holes, the big black holes at the center of galaxies, if you're counting one for one, are small compared to the
Total numbers are small compared to the galaxies, right? That's true.
No, but also compare, I mean, the typically the numbers for black stellar, you know, 10 solar mass, 3 solar mass kind of black holes produced as supernova remnants run 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 per this galaxy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, which is much more.
But still, you get the number, you had some nice repulsive force that would keep the galaxies apart. You'd get more black holes, right? Because they wouldn't merge. So maybe we predict.
I'd be happy to talk about that after. I don't have a clear answer.
A related question, which would be, if you had a theory that produced a lot of primordial black holes.
That's the delta rho over rho question.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So to be taken serious, so the claim is that this method leads to a theory which, if true, it may be false, but if true, genuinely explains some things about the fine tunings, but it must also make predictions. And I'm sorry, I forgot to write this controllable rather than falsifiable. Okay, and I'll just discuss, I've alluded to one of them, and I'll discuss one other of them, because I'm running short on time and I want to say some things to conclude. There's clearly a bottleneck here. Once you have a supernova, then you have a remnant. And the physics of supernova remnants are that there's an upper mass limit, which demarcates remnants which become neutron stars versus remnants which become black holes. Remnants with less mass become neutron stars, and therefore it's clear that if there is selective pressure to make more black holes, one wants to know, one expects that the universe will have taken advantage of every opportunity to tune the upper mass limit of neutron stars to be as low as possible. And here lies an interesting little tale. Okay. So the computations of the upper mass limit are done via nuclear physics, and roughly speaking, well, there are different scenarios, but I'll discuss two. There's a sort of standard scenario in which a neutron star is made up of neutrons. In the collapse of the remnant, the electrons and protons combined to make neutrons and neutrinos. The neutrinos went out blowing off the supernova, and you're left with a big bag of neutrons. And the estimates for the upper mass limit in those cases range between 2 and 3, depending on the assumptions in the model. And there may, I should say that, you know, there may have been, I haven't looked into this carefully for a few years, so there could always have been progress, but that's what it was a few years ago. Then there's an intriguing proposal by Hans Bethe and Jerry Brown, one of the things that Hans Bethe worked on a lot in his last years, in which they claim, for several reasons, most of them irrelevant for this, that neutron stars are actually K-minus condensates. That is, that as the density of nuclear matter increases, the electron mass, so this is density, and this is mass, the electron mass renormalizes up, the kaon renormalizes, the K minus renormalizes down because it's attracted to the nuclei. And the scenario is that at some point they cross, and at this point, the electrons decay to K minuses plus neutrinos. And therefore, one is left with a bag of protons and neutrons and K minuses rather than protons and neutrons. And if this scenario is correct, then the equation of state is much softer. Naively, there are two species of fermions, not one species of fermions. And calculations done by their collaborators and other people come up with about 1.6 solar masses for the upper mass limit. Okay. Now, one can argue as follows. There is certainly a critical value of the strange quark mass, and hence the initial kaon mass, above which this scenario is true. I'm sorry, below which this scenario is true. If the strange quark mass is below some critical value, then one can deduce that this is what happened. If it's above that critical value, then this requires densities above the densities where the standard process of protons plus electrons to neutrons and neutrinos takes place, and therefore it's not true. So the prediction is that the strange quark mass has to be below some critical value. Now, there's a literature about that, okay, and we don't have to get involved in that because it depends on the details of models, chiral perturbation theory, etc., that nuclear physicists have been doing, and we don't have to get involved in exactly the question of whether what the critical value is and is the strange quark mass that we measure below the critical value, because this is a scenario according to which it must be true. If the strange quark mass is above the critical value, then nature did not use an opportunity to tune its parameters in order to make more black holes. And therefore, there would be a way to tune a parameter in a way that, by the way, in this range, there isn't much implication for the existence of life or carbon or anything in what the strange quark mass is. It would be much, much lower down, but it's not in this range. So nature has not taken advantage of an opportunity if this is wrong. And therefore, it acts as evidence against this scenario. So this is a highly vulnerable scenario, a highly vulnerable prediction to this confirmation, because all that has to happen is the observation of a neutron star with a mass above 1.6 solar masses, and the scenario of Brown and Beta is disconfirmed, and it counts as evidence against this scenario for cosmology. So this is another place where there's a big vulnerability. Where does it stand? So again, you know, compared to eternal inflation, this is a tiny little literature about this, but there are from time to time some papers. This is a recent paper, the most recent about this by Jerry Brown and collaborators. I think it's appeared recently in Physical Review Letters. And the important thing is that there were, in fact, over the last several years, some dangerous cases, and I'm not going to force you to read through this whole thing, but there was a case of a particular neutron star, which is seen in X-rays coming off its accretion disk. So this is not a binary where there's a good measurement from the Taylor kind of binary pulsar measurements. These are measurements that are made by making models of accretion disks and predicting, as a function of the neutron star mass, what should be the spectrum of X-rays off the accretion disk. And there was a dangerous case, that one there. And part of the news is that the mass estimates have been redone, and the estimated mass has gone down from 2.1 plus or minus 0.2 to 1.6 plus or minus about 0.1. Okay. So this is good news. Until recently, when I gave a version of this talk, I ended here and said there's a very dangerous case, and it's probably disconfirmed. But the dangerous case seems to have gone away. Nonetheless, the point is that any week there could be a paper reporting the discovery of a new binary pulsar with well-measured masses above 1.6 solar masses, and this would count as a clean disconfirmation. Okay, so here is the delta rho over rho argument. I'm going to wrap up because I have about 5 minutes. Let me refer you to the literature. Somebody can ask. There's a last prediction about the supernova rate very early before the medium was enriched. So let me just skip that for now and come to some conclusions. And I want to emphasize that these are methodological conclusions. I'm not interested here in making a comparison between some eternal inflation model versus this model. I want to talk about the methodologies that are used to deduce explanations and deduce predictions. And the key issues, so these are the two cases that I call time-dependent. I guess I would have saved myself trouble to call it time-dependent earlier, or static ensembles of landscape theories. And roughly speaking, although there are some extreme cases, if you have a static random probability distribution generated by a process which is insensitive to the details of the fine-tuning problem, that is to what the photon-neutron mass difference is, for example, then you end up not being in a position to make any but very extreme predictions, a few extreme predictions, and you end up having to rely on the anthropic principle strongly because you have to because the proposal is that our universe is a very untypical member of the ensemble that the scenario proposes exists, and therefore you have to use the anthropic principle to cut down the ensemble to one that we're typical, that it's claimed we're typical of, and that weakens the empirical content of the theory dramatically because you're very vulnerable to different arguments about different notions of typicality and sensitivity to different notions of typicality. The other methodology mimics biology, and it mimics biology consciously because biology is the only case we know about in science where a special tuning, a fine-tuning problem has been explained, over and over again. And it results in scenarios where our universe is claimed to be a typical member of an ensemble. That is, one can isolate properties that the scenario predicts almost every universe has, such as being near a local extremum. And one goes looking to disconfirm those typical properties. So it's methodologically much cleaner, and therefore much more vulnerable to disconfirmation, and also offers the possibility of genuine non-anthropic explanations for puzzling features of our universe, like why there are galaxies or why there's so much carbon around, or what the value of the strange quark mass is. So my point is that learning from, before I make the final summary, let me sort of emphasize that different people in this literature have focused on different issues. And there's been a lot of focus on the cosmological constant. And I haven't shown it, but there's a sort of obvious version of Weinberg's argument in the context of cosmological natural selection for a non-zero cosmological constant of basically the same prediction that Weinberg makes. Much of the literature is focused on the issue of the cosmological constant, which is one of the most puzzling issues in all of fundamental physics, for sure. But my sense is that there's a lot also to be gained by going back and puzzling about the other special tuning problems, like the photon-neutron mass difference, the fine structure constant, the Fermi constant, because there is a long list of, quote, coincidences that are, quote, anthropically explained, and that, in my view, we would be in a better situation if we had genuine non-anthropic explanations for it. So let me just close with a quote of Dan Dennett, who is a booster for evolution, in which he is arguing that the power of the methodology, this is not, by the way, this is not some, you know, California, if you let me, some California thing of the universe is alive and we're all part of one thing. Okay. So it's nothing to do with that. This is,
okay? This is sort of California.
This is, okay. Anyway, yeah, there's a bunch of Californians, but I apologize. It's also kind of, that kind of talk is also kind of Canadian, isn't it? But the point that I'm making is that there is a methodology about treating cases where do we have to explain a fine-tuning and special tuning problem, and that adopting this methodology, which one might think lessens the empirical content of physics, in fact seems to increase the empirical content of physics, at least if we go in the direction of multiverse theories. So let me stop there. Thank you.
In the last 10 minutes, I thought of, I think, two parameters that
right.
I think sound to me like when tuning them, you should be able to increase the number of black holes.
Okay.
So first of all, if I increase the coupling G1 in the standard model, keeping the W mass fixed, so the Fermi constant is the same,
okay.
Then the neutrino cross sections are bigger, and the probability of supernova explosions actually occurring gets larger because neutrinos can't escape as easily. And this was in fact for a long time, it's even not, I think, completely settled today, but for a long time supernova theorists couldn't get supernova to explode because the neutrino cross sections were too small according to the pre-standard model leaking reaction. Make them a little stronger, I think you have more supernova explosions. Will that lead to more black holes?
There's a window, and one side of the window, one side of the argument is you're right. They have to be strong enough to interact strongly with the envelope and therefore give energy to the envelope and blow it off. But this is also found on the other side, they have to get out of the remnant.
Okay.
And so I don't know how to think about this in terms of G1 and G2. I follow the literature and thinking about this in terms of G Fermi and the fine structure constant, but I'd be happy to go and look at it. But it's not that one, if one just increases the neutrino coupling, one after
just
factor.
Just increase it a little. Right?
Well, that's what
there's
at.
A window.
There's a window, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it seems to be that moving up within that window, you would increase the number of black holes.
So I have only thought about thinking in windows. So I would take that as good advice in thinking about that.
Okay. And the other one is, of all the theories of dark matter that I know of, both axion theories and various kinds of WIMP theories, have in them tunable couplings that people tune in order to get the dark matter density to start dominating at the time that we know it did from observation. But again, it seems to me that if instead you tuned it so that it started dominating a little bit earlier, you could get more black holes. So.
Yeah, I have not thought about it. I have thought about thinking about the dark matter, but I have not thought about it indeed. So that sounds like
you've got to be careful, though, because you need to make stars. You need to radiation. Wimps can't make stars. So, something else is using black holes.
But there's a variant.
Right.
So I'm trying to understand your argument a bit better. So you have a move that says the measure on the set of universes better not be random, otherwise we won't get falsifiable predictions because everything will be as likely as everything else.
A and B, this is a kind of scale argument. We're unlikely to have insight about or explain the special tuning problems. Why the proton neutron mass differences inside the window it's supposed to be in. Why the Fermi constant is inside the window it's supposed to be in. So those are two separate arguments.
Okay, let me just focus on the first one.
Yes.
So I have a sort of typical philosopher's problem, which may or may not turn out to be unimportant nitpicking, I'm not sure. It's just the worry that, okay, so he says he doesn't want random probability measures, but I don't know what that means because every measure is random relative to itself and non-random relative to any other probability measure. So
it
must be non-random relative to what?
So I mean, there's not, so a more careful thing to say would be, is uncorrelated with the existence of this small region F where life can occur. So when the
uncorrelated.
That is the probability distribution is not generated by or does not know about the physics that is relevant to the existence of this region F where life can exist. So what I really mean is if you push me, I mean, I have some things in mind, but if you push me, what's playing a role in the argument is uncorrelated with the physics that selects out the region F from the rest of the standard model parameter space.
Okay. I think I'm too confused about this for this to be a quick conversation, so I'll ask you later.
Okay.
How does this fit in with quantum gravity? Because you need classical spacetime just to define what a black hole is. Right, but in quantum gravity, classical spacetime is not generic. So aren't you going to need some unexplained fundamental law that will give you classical spacetime?
So you could be asking this at several.
What?
You could be asking this at several levels. So I certainly need quantum gravity for the bounce.
No, but just to explain the spacetime in which you have. Why should there be any correlations at all if you find a horizon or any other such notion?
No, sure. But I'm not so ambitious that I have tried to make an argument of, you seem to be suggesting there might be an argument of the form of some parameters in fundamental theory are tuned so that there is a low energy limit where general relativity emerges.
Classical behavior emerges that's necessary.
Right. I mean, those are very interesting questions, and I could imagine thinking about them through a lens of this methodology, but I certainly have not done so.
Okay. One more question. I mean, wouldn't we predict the cosmological constant to be negative? Because then we'd have a big rip, which would create more black holes in the far future.
This is great. This is another new talk. So I.
You realize if you're going to give a talk like this, people in the audience are going to sit here thinking.
This is good. This is why.
Well, you just one singularity. You'll only count it once.
maybe you can get through it. Is it connected with Roger's idea at all? That you can get through the big rip or something like that?
The big. The big rip. Does this mean I have to pay attention to the big rip? I guess it does.
Isn't that what it's called? Maybe.
Yeah. No, it is.
Big rip is something you must have noticed.
Something electromagnetism?
Right.
The big rip? Okay. Yeah. Whatever it is, it's a final
singularity. Jim, that's not the question I brought you, but can I...
Interesting, the final singularity. Because
I'm sorry.
Can I raise the question I brought you to ask?
Yeah.
Okay, that the whole thing is highly vulnerable to. How come... and this ties this talk with my talk at the last one of these meetings. How come if you work on quantum gravity, then presumably you believe that time is emergent and there's a level of description where there is no time, but then the evolution of this ensemble outside of space-time makes no sense.
Right.
Yeah, so that's a problem that I have worried about, and that was the motivation for the talk I gave last year.
Last year at this I wasn't there, unfortunately.
Okay. So that, which is to say, that's a whole other talk, and I think that that's a very interesting issue.
This question's a bit vague. Okay, so lots of your arguments seem to me to apply just as well in the context of a single universe probabilistic theory as they do in the context of a theory that postulates a multiverse and puts a measure over it. But some bits of the argument, I guess, wouldn't apply in the single universe case. For example, it wouldn't make sense to get a measure over universes from some physical mechanism that generated universes from other universes.
Well, let me tell you about something I spent quite some time on and was disconfirmed. Okay, something that I, before this, that I spent quite some time on, was the idea that there is one universe, and when the parameters are tuned so that nucleosynthesis takes place, that drives an expansion, okay, and that there's a competition to, basically, in other words, there's regions, the picture is these regions of the one causally connected universe where there are different phases and hence different values of the effective parameters, and there are phase boundaries, and there are, the universe is expanding, and they compete to dominate. Mm. And I wondered if there might be a story in which the present values of the parameters are tuned so as to have led to a little region of an initially randomly chosen region expanding faster than other regions. This is not in the context of inflation, but in some post-inflation, because I was trying to get low energy parameters, so I was trying to understand the proton-neutron mass difference. Mm-hmm. And this would work in the context of a kind of cosmological scenario which used to be studied a little bit called the cold Big Bang models, where the Big Bang was initially cold. Okay. And in that scenario, such a scenario would work, but the cold Big Bang model is very thoroughly disconfirmed. For other reasons.
Okay.
So anyway, so I tried to do something within the context of one universe without the bounces, and could not come up with anything that was not easily disconfirmed.
Okay. And my question was going to be, how much of your argument do you think still goes through in very mundane probabilistic context, like classical statistical mechanics? Or something like that, because it seems to me that your arguments for probability measures to need to be non-random in order to get
that part. Yes.
Okay. So does the same argument for non-random probability measures that you're making in the context of multiverse theories also translate into an argument against essentially any equilibrium probabilistic theory, like classical statistical mechanics as we know it?
I think. My answer is between a yes and no. My answer is there are two separate ideas in the multiverse context, in this and other scenarios. One of them is that there's a much bigger, that space-time is much bigger than the region that's simply causally connected to our past. Okay, so there are other regions of space-time that's much bigger. And the second is that those other regions are governed by effective laws which have different parameters or are different in some respect. Okay. And they're not the same idea. It's possible to hope for a cosmology in which the variation of laws over space and time would be, as I described, in different regions separated by phase boundaries. And one wouldn't be faced with the challenges of making explanations and confirmation of a multiverse scenario, which is the basic thing that one doesn't see, but one has difficulty seeing them. So, and in that scenario, in that kind of scenario, what I said would hold. You look like you're not understanding it.
I think we might be talking fast.
Okay, I apologize.
One last question, Marie.
I wonder how exactly the analogy is between cosmic natural selection and biology, because you have in both pictures the differential fitness, that is different reproduction rates, but in biology there's competition between the species and individuals and so on, because they live in the same environment, or at least they share some environment. But in cosmological natural selection, there is no environment.
Yes.
So there is no competition.
Yeah. So of course, there's not a perfect analogy in many ways. The mathematical framework of population biology, in which one has a population evolving stochastically on a fitness landscape, you know, according to an algorithm where the number of the reproduced descendants with the number proportional to your altitude of where you are in the landscape, that kind of thing isn't common and is sufficient. And the rest of it is, I mean, I'm not, you know, there's no reason to overdo it. That core methodology is sufficient and presumably is useful and is used by people who study, you know, trading and finance, economics. I mean, there's lots of application outside of biology of living cells for that methodology. And it's just that methodology of population biology, the mathematical models of population biology that I'm using here.
It's not quite Darwinism in some sense.
It's not quite
Darwinism, because Darwinism and natural selection in the Darwinian sense requires competition. It's not.
Well, Lindmark Lewis would argue with that, but in any case, we don't have to enter into that debate among biologists in order to steal from them some methodology.
Sure.
Great, okay, so let's thank the leader.